Great. Well, we'll go ahead and get started. We have a very hard stop to get everybody back downstairs in time for the luncheon plenary. So we'll go ahead and get started. My name is Gloria Gonzalez. I'm the deputy editor of Business Insurance Magazine. I'm also a soon-to-be ex-member of the board of SCJ. And why am I here? Well, one of the reasons I pitched this session when they were gathering submissions is because I've been writing a lot about flooding issues. Flooding, I'm sure most of you already know, is the costliest natural disaster catastrophe in the United States and also in Canada as well. We would have had a speaker here. Fortunately, he couldn't make it to talk about. Can you? I'm sorry. They said that this. There was no amplification. I will try to speak very loudly then. I'm a New Yorker, so that should not be a problem. So basically, I was saying why we're here today. One of the issues I found in covering flood risk is that I think there is a misperception that it's a coastal issue. And I think that obviously, it is a coastal issue to some extent, but we are seeing flooding in communities all across the United States. And we are seeing that people are starting to recognize that perhaps that recognition is not at the level as it should be. But that's one of the reasons we're here to talk about where these flood risks are, what's propelling them, and also what is being done to address them, both on a policy level and at the local community mitigation level. So one of the things that I think is a big challenge, and we saw it with regard to Hurricane Florence, in the National Flood Insurance Program. Unfortunately, many people in the affected areas are either underinsured or not insured. Penetration of NFIP coverage in those areas, very low single digits. So a lot of those people who have been affected are going to be reliant on disaster recovery funds if they come through at the level that they will be needed. So one of the key topics that I write about is how does the National Flood Insurance Program get reformed so that it's actually providing the coverage that they need and at the rates that are appropriate, and really trying to deal with an escalating risk and expanding risk of flooding. We're going to start with our first speaker is Steve Ellis. He is with Taxpayers for Common Sense, which is part of the Smarter Safer Coalition. And basically, this is a really interesting coalition because it's a number of different types of organizations who have all come together to try to advocate for reforms for the National Flood Insurance Program. And the reason why it's important, it's different types of organizations. You have insurers, you have your organization, and others, and environmental groups, and others who all recognize the scope of the problem and are trying to figure out some common sense solutions to it. So why don't you tell us a little bit about your organization and also what it is exactly that you're advocating for the National Flood Insurance Program.
Sure, and I'll kind of go over some of the issues with the Flood Insurance Program as well. But thank you very much for you all to be here, and thank you for inviting me. I really appreciate it. So I'm the Executive Vice President of Taxpayers for Common Sense. We're a national nonpartisan budget watchdog. Our co-founders, we were founded about a little more than 20 years ago. Our co-founders were the originators of the Green Scissors Report, which was cutting wasteful spending that also harms the environment. And so just as a plug for taxpayers, even beyond flood, we work on a lot of areas where there's the nexus of waste and risk. And so we work on energy issues, agriculture issues. I originally got hired 19 years ago to head up a water program and then now do a lot of our budget and tax work and other stuff along those lines. So just happy to answer questions about after this about taxpayers as well and work with you all. And then about Smarter Safer, this is a coalition that's been around now for, I think, more than 10 years. What I'd like to say is we work on things that have better protect taxpayers, better protect the environment, and better protect people. There's also housing interests and consumer interests that are part of this coalition. We've worked on reforming disaster policy as well as the flood insurance program and also trying to stop government from going into some wasteful areas. So then about the flood insurance program, I've been working on flood insurance basically my entire professional career. Before I got in this line of work, I was an officer in the Coast Guard. And my very second job in the Coast Guard, I was made the I was the national coordinator for the inland waterway part of the Coast Guard. And that was in the summer, July of 1993, which was the Great Midwest Flood. To your point, Gloria, about flooding happening all over, in, you know, in places that are not coastal. Clearly, that was a huge event in the Midwest, and one that kind of opened my eyes to even the existence of flood insurance and some of the issues around that. The reforms happened after that as a result of that disaster. But the flood insurance program was created in 1968 because there was a perceived lack of affordable flood insurance, and the federal government in the early 70s basically took it completely over. Originally, it had been a partnership with the industry, and now it's really just it's all on borne by the federal government. I like to because I think it was incredibly prescient, but the task force that actually recommended the creation of flood insurance, I just want to, in 1966, I just want to quote from it because, it, like I said, I think it was very prescient. A flood insurance program is a tool that should be used expertly or not at all. Correctly applied, it could promote wise use of the floodplains. Incorrectly applied, it could exacerbate the whole problem of flood losses. For the federal government to subsidize low-premium disaster insurance or provide insurance in which premiums are not proportionate to risk would be to invite economic waste of great magnitude. Well, the program is more than $20 billion in debt, and that's after it was had $16 billion forgiven. I would say that's economic waste of great magnitude. We've seen people develop in floodplains that quite frankly shouldn't be developed or rebuilding the same way in floodplains after disaster. And so those are huge environmental issues and costs, but I'll let my colleagues talk more about that. Just about the flood insurance program where we are now, there's about 5 million policies. There are raised $3.3 billion in premium and protect $1.25 trillion in property. As I said, it was $20 billion in debt, and that was after last year $16 billion was forgiven. That's pre-Florence numbers. So Florence is going to be adding several billion onto that. But as also as was mentioned by Gloria, it should have been added a lot more debt because a lot more people should have had coverage that didn't have coverage, even after you had Matthew going through some of those same areas just a couple years before. The program has a borrowing authority of $30 billion, which is why they ended up forgiving some of that debt after Harvey, Irma, Maria. They were about to tap into that. To put that into perspective, until Katrina in 2005, which also had Rita and Wilma as major storms, the program had a $1.5 billion borrowing authority. And so what happens is what we've seen now is that you had a – Katrina was obviously an outlier storm. It was like $18 billion in loss to the program. And there were a lot of people saying that that was just okay, it's an outlier, black swan event, ignore it. But then you had Sandy in 2012. Matthew, which I just mentioned, was the third costliest disaster to the program, which is, you know, most people don't even remember Matthew unless you were from the Carolinas. Then you had Harvey, which was huge, and then Irma and Maria. And so clearly there are this is a very troubled program, and some of it is because many of the properties are subsidized. The Government Accountability Office, the investigative arm of Congress, estimates that less than half of the properties in the program are paying full risk. And that's because many of the properties are either were built before there was a flood insurance rate map, which is how FEMA determines the rates for various properties. You're either an A zone or an X zone or a V zone. If your property was before that time, you pay a subsidized rate. Also, as you can imagine, and as you all know, sea level rise and other changes or even just a subdivision being built or a big box store with a large parking lot, it changes your floodplain. But even if your risk increases, so you go from a lower risk property to a higher risk property, you get to keep your old rate. It just assumes that you are the same size as before. It's called grandfathering. And so those are the ways that they're subsidized. The other thing is the subsidies are tied to the property. They're not means tested. So the person who has the $20 million home, they're not treated any differently than the person who has a $40,000 home. The Government Accountability Office has estimated that 78% of the subsidized properties in the flood insurance program are in counties with the highest home values, and that's the top three deciles, whereas only 5% of the subsidized properties are in homes in the bottom five deciles of home value. So you have this issue of this, these basically non-means tested subsidies, and subsidies going to people who don't need it. Subsidies are masked, so you don't really know that you got a subsidized property. There's nothing telling you that this is what your rate would be otherwise. So there isn't that risk communication that you would have, that signal of risk. I was going to get into the environment, but I think I'll leave my colleagues to that. But the other thing to think about, though, is when you have the availability of flood insurance has made it safer economically to build along the coast and in higher risk areas, because you're going to have that insurance. You know, you're going to be able to rebuild in these areas. And so what happens is that, you know, we've replaced bungalows with, you know, beach mansions. And then also there's all the concomitant infrastructure that increases, which also gets us concerned, all the other costs. Because when you look at the disaster assistance, it is almost all for the public assistance for rebuilding roads and utilities. There's beach renourishment. There's all sorts of other things that go along with this, having these beach mansions and other development. Also, the program suffers from an adverse selection bias. And then what I mean by that is the only people who buy flood insurance are the people who are most likely to need it and use it. And so just to put that into perspective, the census, last census counted 130 million housing units in the country. Now, you wipe off some of those from multifamily and stuff, things like that. But still, remember, I said there were 5 million policies in the flood insurance program. So there is a very low take-up rate. And also, one-third of the policies are in the state of Florida. If you add in Louisiana and Texas, that's almost that's more than half of the policies in the program are in those three states. So then the last couple things I wanted to mention is that what you have is – so was also mentioned was that there was people who didn't have flood insurance were going to have to rely on individual assistance, disaster assistance. And it's not at all the same thing. So I don't know if you recall, but several years ago there was really heavy rainstorms in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, massive flooding. And FEMA said after that, the people in Baton Rouge who had flood insurance on average got $86,500 on their claims. The people who didn't have flood insurance got $9,100 in individual disaster assistance. You can't rebuild your house. You can't rebuild your life on $9,100 in disaster assistance. So even as just – I mean, we're a budget group, you know, so we're worried about the numbers here. But even just as a human life and a human perspective on this, we have to make changes. And part of that is that we do need to have rates increase, which is happening under previous legislation. It's slowly, but we're satisfied with that. But then, you know, remove the subsidies, but provide means-tested assistance to those who actually need it. We don't want anybody to lose their house or lose their ability to buy flood insurance if they actually need it. And then reduce rates by reducing risk. And what I mean by that is things like mitigation, buyouts, those type of things can actually reduce the rates because we're actually mitigating the risk, which is more of a permanent rate reduction than actually subsidies. And then lastly, and this is where I talk mostly with Gloria about, but is removing some of the obstacles to getting the private sector involved. Flood insurance is written in other countries. It's, you know, the United States created this program in 68 and has basically, you know, held on to it and denied the ability of the private sector to get involved. Now, the thing is to keep in mind, we're in a different world than in 1968. One is, I wasn't here. But two is, you know, you think about it, my smartphone has more commuting power than a room of supercomputers did at that time. And so the modeling that the insurance industry can do, the mapping and the tools that they can use through things like LIDAR and determine, you know, the exact elevation and some of the flooding issues are so much greater in now than they were then. And the insurance industry wants to write flood insurance. They're clamoring. There are 20 companies in Florida right now, more than 20 companies in Florida right now writing first dollar flood insurance. And so we need to remove some of the obstacles to that. Some of that is getting rid of subsidies. Some of that is there's been – it's a technicality about who can write in the highest risk areas and in the so-called 100-year floodplain when there's a 1% chance of flooding in any given year. Make sure that private companies can write those policies. And what we'll find is that instead of having to go through some sort of obscure insurer or something that you're not really familiar with, it'll be flow from Progressive selling flood insurance. insurance. It'll be the Geico Gecko selling flood insurance. And so that will become a more normalized thing. It'll become another rider on your policy, and that actually more people will be covered because clearly a lot more people need to be covered. And from our perspective, less risk would be borne by the federal government.
Not so quick follow-up, but one of the issues with the NFIP is that it's continually allowed to come to the brink of expiration, if not actually expire, and then retroactively be enacted. So why can't Congress get an overhaul of the NFIP done?
Well, I mean, one thing is, and I've learned this from lots of different stuff, I mean, Congress is like a college kid on a deadline, you know? I mean, essentially, if you give them another week to finish the term paper, they'll take another week to finish the term paper. I was that way. The last, before the 2012 long-term reauthorization, there were 17 extensions and four lapses. We've already had several extensions, and, you know, it expires November 30th. The House has actually done a reform bill that I mean, we think could have been approved, but we supported. The Senate just won't get off top dead center. I mean, they really don't even have – I mean, there's a couple lawmakers who put forward packages, but, you know, you have this issue that you find in other things where you have concentrated benefits. Remember I said that half of the policies are in those three states, and you have widely dispersed costs. And so, you know, everybody else who's paying – or, you know, is owed the debt, are not as pushing their senators to do this as much as the people who are mostly involved, which are the kind of the Sandy senators and the so New York, New Jersey, and the Louisianans.
Indeed. Great. We'll go next to Velma Smith, who's the manager, senior officer at the Government Relations with the Pew Charitable Trust. Obviously, this is a topic that is near and dear to your heart. Yeah, I know you work directly with some of these communities who are vulnerable. So why don't you tell us a little bit about your work and how you're working with communities on these flooding issues.
Sure. Thank you, Gloria, and thanks, everyone, for coming and so we could have a conversation about this important issue. I just to introduce you to the what we're calling the Flood Prepared Communities Project. It's an initiative not quite as old as Steve's project, but a couple of years old, and we have some very ambitious goals, trying to, one, reform federal flood insurance, help with that reform, two, reorient disaster policies to favor preparedness over recovery, three, make the nation's infrastructure resilient to the floods of the future. So instead of, you know, building the roads, putting hospitals in places that look slightly okay today, locate and build them in ways that they'll survive in the future. And four, enlist Mother Nature in the fight against flooding through conservation and restoration. And I think Sarah's going to talk about some of that. Hopefully our advocacy and our research has moved the needle a little on these points, but the needle on this one really gets a lot of resistance. Yes, flooding costs cuts across these issues, cut across party lines. There's regional, you know, breakdowns, but there are a lot of moving parts, and there's a lot of controversy. And there's a lot of policies that have been ingrained for a long time, and it is very hard to make change. As Steve alluded to, the 17 delays, and we're doing it. It looks like we're going to do it again. I don't know if – hopefully we won't hit 17. But there's not – and also there just doesn't seem to be – people are all looking for the sweet spot for flood insurance. You know, obviously Congress can't stop the rain, but they're hoping that they can remedy flooding, and everybody wants to lower flood insurance premiums. The sweet spot seems to be a balance that would make flood insurance rates affordable and attractive to all. Hard to find, assures that NFIP stops using the federal treasury as an ATM when it has a big storm or several storms in a single year. Sends a strong price signal against unwise development of flood-prone areas. You know, it's not just the edge of the coast. It's along the moving river with a high erosion rate. It's, you know, filling in a wetlands. It's It's in a lot of risky places. And also finds a way to help the people that are already there, stuck really deep in some of these floodplains. And when I say deep, I do mean deep, because they may have invested and their houses may be sitting at very low levels in comparison to where the floods can be. But unfortunately, there's just no magic bullet. We've been a long time in creating this problem. I think it is not just... it's not just a problem of the insurance program. It's a problem of how we address flood. If we go back and we think about the insurance program, it didn't start to be just insurance, and it's not supposed to be just insurance. It really was a quid pro quo program. The report that Steve cited from talked about how local communities were making bad decisions about development, and while the federal government didn't have authority to direct development itself, and no one was proposing that it would, there had to be some kind of mechanism to try to encourage communities to do better planning and development decisions with regard to flood risk. And the positive thing is there are 22,000 communities participating. There's probably several thousand of those who have no other land use controls other than what they're required to have for participating in the NFIP. We've got thousands of certified floodplain managers across the country. There's much better awareness than there was 50 years ago. So when we're looking at the failings, there are some positive pieces, too, to the NFIP's history. But in terms of looking both at how we treat disaster policy and insurance, we've got to make some changes. We think, even though there's no magic bullet for Congress and they're trying to find that sweet spot, there's at least a few simple things they could do now and that would help the future. One of them, I think, is that it's almost like this alarm's been going off, the car alarm out in the parking lot, and nobody's paying attention to it. And the alarm, after 50 years of the NFIP, hundreds of disaster declarations involving flooding, more and more every year, FEMA, its state partners, its local partners know, or they ought to know, the neighborhoods, the houses, the streets, the communities that flood over and over again. They know that within the NFIP, within the flood insurance program, there's a small fraction of policyholders that account for a large portion of the claims and the risk. So on the order of, and the numbers are sort of hard to pin down, but it's on the order of 1% of the policies account for, in some years, 30% of the claims. So Congress has to get serious about dealing with these repeat loss properties. We think one of the best ways to do that is on a community level. Instead of just going after the individual property owner, is get the community to focus on what I call flooding hotspots, those areas where there are several of these repeat loss properties repeatedly flooded, and to concentrate and figure out, well, what's our priority to how do we address this? Can we do buyouts here? Can we improve? Sometimes it's a matter of drainage. Some communities you find they aren't cleaning the culverts. They aren't, doing the drainage. So they can improve the drainage. Maybe they have to do some investments. The other thing they can do is the community can say, well, what were the factors when this place was built? And maybe we need to change the criteria that we have for planning and zoning decisions so we don't create new repeatedly flooded areas. So that's one of the things they can do. Two, we've got to make, as Steve alluded to, pre-storm mitigation a priority. We can't, where the balance is really off kilter. We spend billions only after the damage has been done. We inconsistently support pre-disaster mitigation. Oftentimes, we're offering the largest share of disaster assistance and mitigation, disaster assistance afterwards, to the communities that have done the worst job of protecting themselves, not necessarily the ones that are trying to do the best job and adapting to their own community's vulnerabilities. So the changes there that we've endorsed involve creating a mitigation revolving loan fund, something that would be stable, would create a stable source of funding. A bill on this regard was introduced in the Senate by Senator Reid of Rhode Island and Senator Kennedy of Louisiana. There are little regional differences there. And we're hopeful that today it would be a pro forma introduction. A House bill will be introduced, a companion to that, by Representative Crist of Florida, along with Representative Williams of Texas, is what we're hoping to hear any moment. So putting pre-disaster funding on a more stable footing, allowing for long-term planning, helping states to build institutional capacity and mitigation. The other thing, just last week, and it's a small thing, and there's, you know, it's a big package, so there's a lot in it, but the Disaster Recovery Reform Act had some provisions that try to put a little encouragement to communities to adopt the latest building codes, a little finger on the scale in terms of those communities that might get disaster assistance in terms of who goes to the front of the line for competitive grants, also helping communities pay for enforcing building codes with disaster dollars. So that's and setting aside allowing the president to set aside up to an amount equivalent to 6% of certain disaster accounts for a pre-disaster mitigation fund. And that fund could be tapped to go out for competitive grants so that communities can compete and try to do that pre-disaster projects. You know, hopefully over time, then we'd make consideration of flood risk a part of how communities plan their infrastructure, their housing developments, their, you know, business investments, rather than an afterthought. One third thing, Congress can change the flood future by making people flood savvy. If you're buying a used car, you can check the Carfax. If you want to know about the quality of the schools where you're going to buy a house, go to Zillow, go to whatever. You can get some ratings on schools and find out about the performance of those schools. But if you're buying a house or renting an apartment, you might not know about the flood risk until you lose it all, until you have a flood. So, again, that's one of the things we want to change in the NFIP and that bill that passed the House, as well as the bill that sits there in the Senate, have some disclosure language. And we think that would be a big improvement on NFIP. Now, if they just did those three simple things, a more emphasis on pre-disaster mitigation on a revolving loan fund, disclosure requirements for communities that participate in the program, and dealing with repeat loss properties, we think you could change the trajectory of where the flood insurance program is going. So, you know, that's what we're pushing these days.
Excellent. Thank you.
Thanks.
So, Sarah, I know you're working directly with some local communities on particular projects. Oh, we lost a projection. I'll get that back. On some of these projects to help make them more resilient to these flood situations. So why don't you tell us a little bit about some of the projects that you're working on?
Sure, absolutely. So thanks, Gloria, for inviting me here today. And it's great to see such a good turnout for this discussion. As Gloria mentioned, it says in your pamphlet, I'm a project manager for a program called Thriving Earth Exchange, and we're a program of the American Geophysical Union. We're a scientific society made up of earth and space scientists, so we study anything from the surface of the earth, the center of the earth to the surface of the sun, everything in between. And our program builds collaborations between community members and scientists in order to leverage and address community priorities related to climate change, natural hazards, and natural resource management. And we call this community science. This is our logo in the center here. We've launched over 85 projects worldwide. And you might not have heard of us. This is our first time engaging with the SEJ audience. And I think that you'll find we have a lot of really great local stories to tell about our environment in how communities are working with scientists to address local issues. So come talk to me. We have a lot of ready-made stories. We have an exhibit here. And so I wanted to talk a little bit about kind of how we're structured, because I think it's important to tee up the conversation about flooding. Like I mentioned, central to our work is focusing on local priorities. We start with the things that communities want to tackle. So this includes local context, priorities, local knowledge, all very important when building these collaborative projects. And we also deliver concrete impact. So our community science projects are producing local impacts that are going to result in a physical, institutional, or knowledge-based change in their community. So this could mean a presentation to a civic league, a city council, maps that are being produced by that scientist, green infrastructure designs, infographics, reports, et cetera. We're trying to say that, you know, basic research is important, but giving back and applying scientific expertise to a community can make a world of a difference. So we do this through a number of partners. So we reach new communities through what we call community-facing partnerships. This includes the National League of Cities, EPA's College and Underserved Communities Partnership Program, and a group called Flood Forum USA. And this is a grassroots coalition made up of communities all over the country that are dealing with flooding. We've been engaged with this group for a little over a year now, and they're an initiative of the Anthropocene Alliance. It's probably really small to see that font there. This coalition is made up of residents that are concerned about flooding and the future resilience and survival of their hometowns. So Flood Forum is actually a really interesting model, and I'm really excited to share with you what they're all about. They offer a mix of strategies to these groups that includes legal support, organizing support, technical assistance in science and engineering, which is where we come in, and also education around flood insurance, architectural support, and it continues to expand. So, like I mentioned, we're the technical assistance part. We're currently partnered with about 15 of these flood groups across the country, and we've paired most of them with hydrologists and engineers that are working directly hand-in-hand with that community. And just something I've learned after, you know, having engaged with a number of these communities for a little over a year now, historically, city planners, local elected officials, developers have seen residents as very passive. They're kind of, you know, residents are indifferent about change taking place around them, so we can kind of do whatever we want. And what we've learned is that, you know, residents that have spoken up in the past are either ridiculed or ignored for their activism. At times, they're often dismissed from city council meetings. There's a lot of adversarial relationships between these more grassroots activist groups and their local elected officials. But with the assistance of our program and partnering with Flood Forum, there's a shift that we're seeing that's starting to take place. Community leaders are going from being ridiculed and to actually being sort of hesitantly accepted, and now in some cases actually listened to and admired in some of these cases. So I want to talk a little bit about each of these just very briefly. The partnership with the scientists has been helping a number of these communities build the confidence that they need to speak with their local elected officials. The group in Virginia Beach held a community meeting that drew about 75 people, including city council members, where they talked about stopping how to slow development, and they actually were able to stop the development of a 30-home development in the southern part of the city. Through that meeting. Others have used educational meetings all about hydrology, Hydrology 101, DeSoto, Missouri, which their downtown is actually located in a floodway, so they're having conversations about how to move critical historic businesses and even residents that live near the downtown. So that's a conversation that's been going on there. Others in Lemon Valley, Nevada, and Pensacola, Florida, the scientists have been reviewing engineering reports and translating that information back to the community. We've had undergraduate classes engage in Connellsville, Pennsylvania, get out in people's backyards and take soil samples to better understand the geomorphology and movement of water across the landscape there. We've had scientists in Ocean City, New Jersey, arrange green infrastructure tours in other parts of the state in order to think about how that community could start employing or incorporating green infrastructure into their local planning. In Houston, Texas, we have a hydrologist working with the community there to help them craft and refine a presentation to local elected officials about a golf course that is threatened by development, and looking at understanding and interpreting flood insurance rate maps, which can be very confusing to a local community member. They're very confusing to me. And then we've also, in some cases in DeSoto, Missouri, they've been able to install a gauge on a local stream in order to provide real-time data for the community during flash floods. And some of them have actually engaged DeSoto, Missouri, and Lafayette, Louisiana is looking into engaging with the Silver Jackets program, which is a program of the Army Corps of Engineers, and even asking for targeted studies to better understand hydrology and flooding across the landscape. So one of the kind of common threads that I've noticed across these communities, both coastal and inland, is that they're dealing with, and Velma touched on this, dealing with inadequate or under-maintained drainage systems. These, you know, culverts, drainage systems in neighborhoods aren't often cleaned out at the frequency that they need to be. So Virginia Beach, for example, has been calling on neighbors and residents to call up their local elected officials and say, hey, this is backed up. Would your maintenance crew come and clean it out? So learning about those things, you know, what's happening around you in your local neighborhood has been something that we've been focused on. Another thing is gentrification. This is a really important topic in communities of color and environmental justice communities. There's been the case where some properties have been deemed uninhabitable, bulldozed, and then a new development goes up, raises the property tax, and starts to change the community. So these are things, these sort of social questions, social justice questions need to be incorporated in our discussions. Additionally, these communities have historically seen, sort of a disconnect with their local elected officials when it comes to talking about development. There's really no community buy-in in many of these places, or it's very hard for communities to have a productive conversation with developers in these local places. Can you switch to the next slide for me, please? So this is another thing I wanted to just show to everyone. This is from a Zoom call. We utilize Zoom because these communities are scattered all across the country. And it really shows that there's benefit in the strength in numbers. All of these people have a different experience, but there's a lot of commonality in the flood risks that they face and the vulnerabilities that they face. So Flood Forum is directed by Harriet Festing, who's over on the left there, and she has called together these Zoom calls. Last month it was with an attorney to talk about the topic of flooding and what residents' rights are, and the month before the topic was on the Hazard Mitigation Grant Program and other assistance grant programs talking about compliance and flood recovery. So it's really exciting that Flood Forum is doing this, where they're holding these webinars to lay out the resources that are available to community members. We've also engaged with a social justice-oriented architectural firm based in New York, and then also looking at citizen science and things that people can do at a very local household level to collect precipitation data and present that and start accumulating that information over time. Switch to the last one for me, please. And the last thing I will just leave you with, and I think this is a ripe area for discussion, Flood Forum and Thriving Earth Exchange, along with two other partners, has been awarded a climate migration grant, and this is part of the Consensus Building Institute program. We're working with four communities in Staten Island, New York, Pensacola, Florida, Port Arthur, Texas, and Melbourne, Florida. And these are all places that are threatened by sea level rise, coastal inundation, hurricanes, heavy precipitation, outdated infrastructure. And all four of these communities are communities of color, environmental justice communities. The conversation here is around managed retreat. And I know that's a very polarized term. It's very hard to discuss that. But the difference with this initiative is really putting the reins or the power into the community's hands to have resident-led dialogues about this topic. So the community leaders are all going to drive, direct, and facilitate conversations around this topic. And the difference there is that they're not outsiders. They understand the local history, the culture, the personalities, the opportunities that exist within their own neighborhoods, and they're trusted. They're going to start looking at doing surveys, social media discussions, in-person discussions with their fellow community members to start this conversation. You know, managed retreat is a very sticky subject. It's very hard to do. There have been some programs at a state level, like New Jersey, that have tried this, the Blue Acres program, for example. But at best, these discussions can be very hard to get through in a lengthy process. And at worst, they're really, starting to looking at, in some cases, fueling inequality. They can break apart communities, and they, can leave behind blighted communities. So this is just to say we're starting this initiative. We're kicking it off this fall, and it's just a short 4-month initiative to start these discussions. So the last thing I'll just say is that I had a local community leader. She's a grandmother in DeSoto, Missouri, write a little piece for us on her reflections with engaging with our program. This is in an area of Missouri south of St. Louis. They've had a lot of flash floods. They've lost 3 lives due to the flooding. And they're considering maybe possibly at one point relocating their downtown, which is in a floodway. And she says, quote, "I feel so grateful for each and every person involved. I have big hopes for our small town. I can see it having a future now when all I was seeing for it was a dark, wet ending." And I'll leave you with that.
Well, thank you. So we are at almost the 45-minute mark, which means it's time for Q&A. I obviously have some questions myself, but I will open it up to the audience. SCJ members get priority. Please do not make speeches. I will cut you off. And identify yourself and your affiliation. Start in the back.
My name is Karen Binder. I'm with AgriNews Publications in Illinois and Indiana. My question is really geared to all of you. I'd like to know what your thoughts are on the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. Out there, we're getting some very mixed reviews on whether they're complicating the flooding situations in Illinois, especially along the Mississippi River. And right now, there's an awful lot of talk about federal infrastructure and adding more projects to billions of dollar projects to that list. And a lot of people are very suspicious of the information that the Corps is generating towards these project decisions.
Okay, so just to repeat the question, it's about the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers' impact and role in trying to address the flood risk and their impact in doing so. If you could identify yourselves also when you answer the question, that'd be great.
Sure. So this is Steve Ellis with Taxpayers for Common Sense. Fortunately or unfortunately, I've done a lot of work with the Corps of Engineers over the years. I used to be, I'm on the steering committee of the Water Protection Network, which used to be called the Core Reform Network, so that gives you an idea of my biases in this case. But, I mean, clearly the history with the Corps is that, they've tried to do what happened with the flood damage reduction projects that they've done to date is, and we've seen this over a 60, 70-year period, really since they really got heavily into the business post-World War II, is that they can protect from small and medium-sized floods, but when you're going to have a really big event, then that flood protection is going to be gone. And so one of the things that's very concerning to me about if you recall, I mentioned there was the 100-year floodplain, the 1% chance. That's the only place where you're required, if you have a federally backed mortgage, to buy flood insurance. That requirement is erased if you have greater than 100-year flood protection. So they build you a levee that's 150-year levee. Well, then you don't have to have flood insurance. But I can guarantee you, 150-year, 200-year, that's not much protection at all. And Mother Nature is going to flood you just like you're in the 75-year floodplain like you were before that levee was there. And so that's one of the major concerns. I mean, the big loss in Katrina in New Orleans was failure, and that was actually engineering failure, of the 17th Street Canal and the London Avenue canals in New Orleans, as well as the levees along the Industrial Canal. And so I think the best protection from flood risk is not to be in the floodplain or to be in a much lower floodplain. And so that's one of the issues about the core. The other thing I'll just flag, and then I'll turn it over to my other panelists, is that this is an economic decision, whatever the core does, which means they estimate what is the value of the property that is being protected by this project, and does that outweigh the cost of building the levee, which inevitably means the more valuable, the wealthier the community, the more valuable the properties, the more flood protection you get. Whereas, you know, it's more of a, and again, I'm a budget guy, I understand that, but, you know, you see that along the coast with beach replenishment projects, which the Corps does. When we pay 65% of the initial cost to federal taxpayers, they're 50-year projects, we pay 50% of all the annual maintenance on that. We pay 65% of the cost of people's levees and flood walls and such like that. And so, anyway, my point is that it is kind of an amoral, not immoral, but amoral calculus that the Corps uses in constructing these projects. So I think skepticism is warranted. I think there is a role for flood damage reduction projects. I think that we should try to move more infrastructure out of the floodplain, which is what Velma was talking about with hospitals and things along those lines. But I think that the Corps is an important role, but I think skepticism is warranted.
This is Velma from Pew Charitable Trust. I would just add that your question sort of gives the opportunity to underscore the dynamic nature and what you do in one area, the dynamic nature of flood risk, and what you do in one area can affect another area in a different way. And that, in some cases, Missouri, Illinois, for example, can be the source of friction and disagreement and distrust, is because one community goes to the Corps and says, we've figured out we need this project to help us. But if you haven't looked at the whole watershed and you don't know what the rolling implications are going to be, then, you know, that's another complication to this calculus that they have. So it's difficult, and this is true. It's not only for the Corps, but the communities that build in a floodway or allow fill for a floodplain, you know, the decisions that get made on the ground, it's not just that the climate is changing, it is also that we change how we use land, and that affects flood risk. That so this line that designates this is the 100-year floodplain, it's not static. It's quite movable, and that's the problem.
It's a crass way to put this, but a levee is a tool to flood your neighbor.
I don't have a ton more to add. I think Velma and Steve were able to really characterize it well. I would just add that there is quite a bit of deep distrust for the Army Corps of Engineers. Louisiana is, you know, a classic example of that. We do have a case where the Silver Jackets program, Army Corps and other partners have been involved with this group in Missouri and are really trying to start looking at more integrated solutions. So I think that there are some good stories to be told out of it. I guess that's all I would add at this point.
Indeed.
I'm Kate Simon with the NPR station Miami, WLRN, and my question is about parametric insurance. I'm wondering if that's anything that any of your organizations see as a good potential reform for the NFIP, or if it's anything that
Yeah, I'll let my panelists and then I have some thoughts on that. The question is about parametric insurance and how it could be used to address the flooding risk. Is the gist of it, right?
Certainly, it's this is Steve Ellis with Taxpayers for Common Sense. The parametric insurance is a great tool. I mean, we saw that the Metropolitan Transit Authority after Sandy, so the subways in New York, they actually purchased that because they couldn't get their cap bond renewed, or at least at a reasonable price. And so it actually tied it to the stream gauges in New York. And if it hits a certain level in the stream gauges, they know that it's going to flood, and so therefore it pays out immediately. And then that's a way that people could invest and understand that this was actually it was a parametric bond, so that they could actually invest and have a little bit more confidence in that when it was going to flood or not going to flood. It also provides the incentive to the MTA that if they can do measures that will prevent the flooding, even at that stream gauge level, that's just money in their pocket. And so I think that's a good tool. Also, the city of Mobile. So I'm moving beyond flood insurance. These are more like communities doing that. They did the same thing with if a tropical depression of a certain size is in a certain part of the Gulf, then they also have a payout of their parametric insurance. So I think it's a tool that's being developed that's very, in a nerdy way, exciting. The flood insurance program has started purchasing reinsurance. They used it immediately right after they paid it. They basically, Harvey took up the $1 billion that they bought. They bought more this time. And so I think those are all important and tools, and that actually gets to my comment, too, about where we're in a different place than 1968. You know, we have a worldwide reinsurance market. We have cat bonds. We have parametric insurance. We have all sorts of other things that are available that were not available in 1968.
And it sounds like it's mostly private sector.
Right. So the private sector has been actively pursuing parametric insurance tools, usually in the wind context, hurricanes, from a wind perspective, but they are using it on a flooding perspective. And Steve mentioned that one of the things that the NFIP is doing, this is Gloria Gonzalez, by the way, one of the things that NFIP is doing is that it's actually incorporating some of these private sector tools to the extent that it currently can. And he mentioned the reinsurance purchase. That was an interesting situation because it was only in force for, that policy was in force for about 8 months, and it was then Harvey hit. And it was a full claim limit. That meant all the reinsurance was used up. There was a full claim on it. And what happened the next time around when it came up for renewal, more reinsurers participated in the program. There was more capacity for the NFIP to actually cover more of the risk. And one of the reasons why the private sector is comfortable to do that is because they can use tools like parametric insurance and technology to try to get a better sense of the risk. So they feel comfortable taking more of that on because they have the tools and technology to do that. There was also separately a placement, a catastrophe bond placement with regard to tapping the insurance like security markets. That's a broader source of capital than the insurance. It's not just insurance playing in that space, but it's just another form for the NFIP to get more private sector coverage of the risk. They're somewhat limited to what they can do because Congress really does have to make some changes to allow for more private sector participation, but that the NFIP, as much as possible, is really trying to tap into those markets using things like parametric insurance. So parametric insurance, it's a form of modeling in a sense, and basically it's using data to try to really break down the risk in different dynamics, you know, using, for example, this kind of complicated topic to explain, but it's using different elements, like, for example, wind speeds and using historical data, but also being more forward-looking, trying to model the risk out a little bit more in an in-depth way. So I can send you some more, a better explanation than that. It's kind of a complicated
concept. But that provides the trigger for the payment rather than we're going to go, we're going to figure out exactly how much damage has happened, and then we're going to write you a check for that. And so,
Right, exactly. So
it's, so for the insurer, it's great because the payment is that much faster and immediate rather than, okay, you had this much damage and that much damage, so we're going to pay off your claim that way.
Right.
And one of the benefits of it is that you don't get into these arguments about causation, which we've seen in other storms. It's like, you know, well, was this caused by wind or was this caused by flooding? And, you know, for example, the trigger may be in the situation with the windstorm, you know, did the windstorm hit 125 miles per hour, for example? I'm just throwing that out, that that's not always a trigger, but the claim would be triggered and automatically pay out if you hit those specific metrics that have been attached to the policy.
So I'm Mark Schlestein with the Times-Picayune in New Orleans. And I haven't heard a discussion about the effectiveness of using 100-year level for the National Flood Insurance Program, whether or not that is now realistic anymore. And also, the program's requirement that it's based on the present snapshot of risk rather than the potential of a flood occurring over the 30-year life of a mortgage, even if not longer period. Could you all address that?
Sure. Good to see you, Mark.
So the question was regard to using the current 100-year levy metrics to try to address a risk that is evolving and changing.
Well, one thing that was in the 2012 reauthorization that got stripped out at the very last minute was a residual risk purchase requirement, which gets to what I was talking about, that if you had, 200-year level protection, so a half percent chance a year that you would have a flood, that you would have to purchase flood insurance taking into account that level of protection, but that you still had to have the purchase because you were originally in the 100-year floodplain. That makes sense. And that got stripped out at the very last minute, unfortunately. So I think there hasn't been a lot of discussion, I think, of ratcheting up the mandatory purchase requirement. We would be supportive of it because basically this is all exposure to Fannie and Freddie, and we're still owning Fannie and Freddie. I mean, that's the whole tie from a federal taxpayer point of view. Also, we would certainly support, doing more. You're right. It is a snapshot. You have places like that flooded in Sandy and in Manhattan that hadn't had an updated flood map because people kept appealing the flood map for decades. And so clearly there's been a little bit of development in Manhattan over time, So, I think that looking at these future conditions and things along those lines are exciting. And again, technology's allowed that modeling a lot better. And it's something certainly the private sector is doing when they're offering their flood insurance. The static rate maps that the NFIP does are woefully out of date in many cases. The state of North Carolina is a major leader in floodplain mapping. They did they basically took the money that FEMA was going to use, and they did LIDAR, had planes flying over, and you can go online and you can check out not only, your flood risk, but then you can also see if, this storm, you can do future casting. And these are individuals. Homeowners can do this. Meteorologists can do this. Federal agencies were using the state of North Carolina's information going into Florence. And so I think that those are areas where there needs to be greater development. But I also think that it's going to end up being that the private sector is going to be doing this more because it's going to be in their financial interest to have a better understanding of the risk, whereas FEMA, it's not their money that's being paid out.
This is Velma from Pew Charitable Trust. I think there are some major problems with continuing to use we misunderstand and use in the wrong way the 100-year floodplain. It's a statistical construct, and yet people seem to think it's a prediction of this is the only area that will flood and it will stop at this line if the map is right. And that's just not true. I think the other problem that we have is even if you – I think there could be a discussion about having mandatory purchase beyond that area, but it is not a discussion that's politically alive at this moment. But on the other hand, the problem we have is we use that line for the wrong purposes. We use that line just to say, okay, you've got to have an arbitrary line to say who has to buy flood insurance. But then we turn around and the program we have that tells communities how to manage their floodplains in order to be in compliance with the federal rules, we let them use the same line. So that is where it is really essential that we start looking beyond the 100-year floodplain, because, you know, we end up, you allow the development to come right up to that line that is not static, and then later on you're going to give those people a subsidy. When we change the map, we'll say, oh, gee, you followed all the rules, where there were no rules in many instances on the other side of that line. So we have to improve our floodplain management at a local level to look at future risks. Places like Charlotte-Mecklenburg, North Carolina, what they did a number of years ago, even before improvements in North Carolina's mapping, what they did was take a look at their zoning ordinance and what they would allow for development and run it out, run a scenario, and look what would, if we develop the way we're planning to develop, what does our flood risk look like in the future? And, you know, and it's the moment where you go, oh, my goodness, we've got to change. They had to then go through the process, the community process, of doing some painful changes to their planning and zoning requirements, because they realized they were creating new flood risk and greater flood risk as they were growing. And I think basically the floodplain rules that FEMA has that haven't been updated since the 80s need to be updated so that more communities are doing that kind of self-examination.
The other piece of that is that under flood insurance, if your home is damaged 50% plus $1, you have to rebuild, and that gives an impetus to locals to make sure that homes are not damaged 50%. I have that 15 feet of water in it was gutted to the studs, and it was 47%.
Yes, exactly.
So
amazing how that works.
Should there be changes in that as well?
I think there's a lot of gaming of the system. I think no matter what system you do, there's going to be some gaming of the system. I mean, it's also that there's, you know, if you get a payment, even if you get disaster assistance, there's often a requirement that you have to purchase flood insurance after that. That is not well enforced. You know, why the lenders don't actually enforce the flood insurance when it's their money at stake is also very curious in a lot of ways. So I think that there should be changes to what are the requirements. And I have no problems with, if you're handing out federal cash, I have no problems with attaching more strings to it.
This is Velma. On that point, I'll also point out that under the Biggert Waters Act, that 50% had dropped to 30. And then when they rolled back Biggert Waters, they moved it back up to 50. But some communities are a little tougher in that they can change that. They can also look cumulatively. So that if a property, so, you know, I've heard people refer to some properties that flood just a little bit as the carpet soakers, the properties that flood over and over again, just a small amount. But if you look at damages cumulatively over time, then you start to incentivize, okay, I really have to do something about, you know, mitigating against this.
Sources of information that are tracking and publishing state-level developments in response to this problem, it being very hard to follow what's going on at a sub-federal level. So is anyone out there doing that?
So the question is about state-level sourcing of information on flooding risk.
Yeah, or state responses or regional metropolitan.
State responses to the flooding risk as well.
This is Velma. I don't know of any single place that covers it all, but there are, and part of the problem is that there are so many places with, you know, the Georgetown Climate Center, there's other folks that, you know, are writing up case studies. FEMA itself has mitigation success stories, but I haven't seen them assembled in a way that you could just constantly go there. I think there's a university in Virginia that has a website. So there's information out there, but it's not all in an easy-to-locate situation. Actually, good news is actually FEMA asked to come talk with us, and they're talking about how can we use more information. The Digital Coast data of NOAA, I think, is starting to do some of this as well. So I think people are thinking about the need for something like that.
And historically, FEMA has been very reluctant to publish much data. Now, obviously, you know, don't want to know that Joe Brown flooded X number of times, but, you know, to get down to that property level data or close to it is be very valuable to try to identify some of these hot spots. But it's something that FEMA has been very reluctant to do. You can get it at a more aggregate level, but not to get down to that data. And they actually, to do the National Wildlife Federation did a real seminal report on repetitive flood losses in the late 90s, and they had to threaten to sue FEMA to get the data to actually do this documentation to find out some house in Houston gotten paid like 17 times the value of the home over time and things along those lines. And so it's hard, and I think NRDC, Natural Resources Defense Council, just a couple years ago, had to go through the same process or did a Freedom of Information Act and were able to get the information. So to me, those are things where FEMA is just not willing to give it up as freely as I think they should. We're not talking about people's Social Security numbers.
So we have about 5 more minutes for questions. Does anybody else have additional questions? Yes, in the back.
I'm Oliver Morrison from Public Source in Pittsburgh. One of the big issues in Pittsburgh is that there's a lot of money and requirements federally for dealing with stormwater and CSOs running into the river, but there's no requirement that also be used to address flooding at the same time. Can you talk about whether or not there's like economic advantages to addressing those issues at the same time, and whether or not there are programs or possibilities for requiring these different programs that are adding requirements on our communities to sort of coordinate?
Indeed. So the question is related to requirements to address when you're addressing certain projects, stormwater, to address also flooding risk as well, and what are the benefits of that?
Did you? Well, I'll go on one level first, sure. And you probably have some more local examples. But I don't know that there's a requirement, but there's certainly the opportunity. And I think more and more communities are seeing that if you think about both flooding and water quality management together, then you can get a bigger bang for your buck when you plan projects, do river restoration, do stormwater management in ways that slows the water down and lets it infiltrate in certain areas as opposed to running off polluted water into your streams. So I think, like, if you look, some communities that have accessed Clean Water Act revolving loan fund money have been able to show that they're doing both CSO improvements and flooding improvements and use the money to do both. I would imagine if we could get something like a flood mitigation revolving loan fund, then you could give credit for, you know, when you look at the cost effectiveness, you could give credit for water quality improvements that you're getting at the same time with improved stormwater management.
Yeah, this is Sarah. I would echo what Velma was saying. You know, a number of the communities, we're actually working with Connellsville, Pennsylvania, which is south, if I'm getting my geography right, southeast of Pittsburgh. And they've been dealing with overburdened storm drains, deep surrounding topographies. There's a lot of undermined land from historical coal mining. And a lot of the community is really concerned about altered shape and size of streams and pushing water in unwelcome places. So I think anything that can be combined to create multiple benefits is a good thing, you know, as long as it doesn't water one down or the other. I mean, no pun intended.
And I think, I mean, some of it is just that the silos within the federal government are make some of that harder, you know. And that's one of the things is trying to, you know, break down the barriers between the Army Corps of Engineers and the EPA and FEMA and dealing with some of these issues. To Velma's point earlier, that, you know, we put so much money post-disaster, you know, it's not even a statutory authorized account, but after each of these major disasters, they stand up what's called the CDBG-DR, the Community Development Block Grant Disaster Recovery Program. And you know, they now have even created another one, the CDBG-M. They did that, which is mitigation future. And so I think those are areas where those accounts, and just to put it in perspective, after Sandy, CDBG-DR got $16 billion. The annual CDBG budget for the entire country is $3 billion. So, I mean, they put that on steroids in there, which is a challenge because then they've got to administer that and they're not stood up for it. But those are areas where you could see those funding serving multiple benefits. The other thing I'd flag is also post-disaster, sometimes there are limitations. Like, for instance, the Army Corps of Engineers, if they're rebuilding something, they can't build it better. So you have an instance of where you had a culvert that flooded a road. When the Corps goes in to rebuild it, well, because it couldn't contain the capacity of the stream, they have to rebuild the culvert exactly the way that they had it before when they knew it was going to flood, rather than actually doing something different. And so I think there are some of these issues where have to think more creatively and also give more flexibility. You know, obviously we're worried about waste or people lining, you know, feathering their nest, but by the same token, we got to do things smarter. And so that would be one way of dealing with those issues.
Indeed, and to follow up on that, there was going to be a federal flood risk management standard via executive order under the Obama administration that was revoked by the Trump administration 3 days before Harvey. So that would have spoken directly to some of the issues and having the federal agencies take a more proactive approach to.
And that just basically required that there be, you know, that you build a couple feet above any federal funding. One is you try to do it to disaster recovery outside the floodplain, but two is that you build it a couple feet above the 100-year floodplain to prevent future flooding. I mean, it seemed like common sense to us.
Indeed. Well, we are. It's 12:10. We do have a hard stop because the plenary is going to start in a few minutes. But if anybody has any additional questions, our panelists will stick around for a while. And I'd like to ask you to join me in thanking them for their insights today.